Well, good morning and welcome to this seminar. For those of you who may not know me, my name is Josh and I serve as a pastor at Redeemer Community Church. I need to say that in part because there are a couple of churches here. I think most people here are from Redeemer. There are also some people from our host church here at Village Baptist. And is Bob in the room? Bob's back here from Village and a few other people from Village. Let me just, before anything else, can I just say thanks to our hosts here at Village for hosting us. Thanks for making this possible for us to be here. And we are glad to get to fellowship with you all this morning as well. So we've gathered together for a seminar about abuse this morning, and this is not one of those like, hurrah, hurrah, let's clap and cheer and get so pumped up and excited about this topic, but it is a very, very important topic for us as the Church of Jesus Christ to pay attention to. Let me say a couple of words about our goals this morning, and then I want to introduce our speakers, and we will get right into it. A couple words about goals. Let me talk about two goals, two big goals that we have this morning, and maybe a third. Is that fair? So big goal number one for this event is we want this event to be equipping for you as a part of the Church of Jesus Christ. We want this to equip you to love your neighbor and to love your neighbor better. We live in a fallen and broken world, and some of the fallenness and brokenness in this world is not just that we sin against other people, but that very often and very painfully, sometimes other people sin against us. And many of our neighbors have experienced that, even if you have not experienced that yourself. And in a world where we're not only people who sin, but people who are sinned against, it's important for us to have a growing skill in wisely, thoughtfully, caringly, loving, and serving our neighbors who have experienced abuse in the past. At Redeemer, I know a number of people here in this room spent a few months last year going through a book called Instruments in the Redeemer's Hands, and we had a number of people going through that book by Paul David Tripp so that we can equip members of our church to be more effective in ministering to one another with the gospel of grace, right? There's a goal that we have at Redeemer, a goal that I believe Village Baptist shares, and a goal that Jesus has for his church, more importantly than any of that, that every member of the body be involved in caring for the rest of the body. I believe in the Church of Jesus Christ. I believe in God's vision for building up people and caring for one another and reaching out in love to our neighbors beyond our church walls. I believe in God's vision for doing that, not just through a few pastors, but through us, through all of us, which includes you if you're a part of the Church of Jesus Christ. And so this event that we're doing, kind of like the study that we did in Instruments in the Redeemer's Hands, this event is designed to help you be better equipped to minister the gospel, to minister with compassion and care, and also with the truth of the gospel of grace to other people that we love around us. So big goal number one of this event is we hope that this event will help to equip you to love and serve others better in the future. Big goal number two for this morning is I hope that in a way, as we do this seminar, I hope that we will come to see God's heart a little bit more clearly. This seminar is not just about learning to love God or love our neighbor more. It also should help us love God more. Because some of the things we'll notice in this seminar should be a reflection of the heart of our God who is near to the brokenhearted. He's not uncaring toward those whose hearts have been broken in this fallen world. He's not distant. He's not unconcerned. He is near to the brokenhearted. And so as we're paying attention to this topic, as heavy and challenging as it is, and as we see some of the ways that God's word speaks to this topic, I hope that one of the things that we'll be seeing, even if in kind of a subtle way today, is we'll be seeing some of God's heart for people. And I hope that that will lead us not only to be better equipped in loving others, but I hope that that will lead us to draw closer and it will draw our hearts to be endeared to this great God of ours who is near to the brokenhearted. So those are the two big goals, that you would be better equipped and that we would see God's heart a little more clearly. But there's a third thing that may happen as well while we're gathered together and doing this seminar this morning, and that may be that maybe as we're talking about these heavy topics, maybe for you personally, maybe for a few of us here in this room, it will stir up emotions for you. Maybe those emotions are related to personal memories in your own life, painful memories in your own life. Maybe those emotions are related to things that you're aware of that have happened to people you love and care about. Maybe those emotions are related to stories you're aware of, related to friends in your life. One way or another, talking about topics this deep may have an effect of kind of connecting at a pretty deeply emotional level with some of us here. And as that's happening, even though the design of this is not, the design of this seminar is not specifically designed or put together in such a way as to kind of most help those who have experienced abuse in the past, we realize that God will be ministering to some people here in this room throughout the morning. And as that's happening, you know, I want to give everybody in this room freedom to just kind of get up and stretch your legs if you need to. Get up and take a deep breath. You can stand in the back of the room. Maybe at some point while we're talking, there are some things that might just lead you to say, I've heard a lot and this is meaningful, but I just need a minute to kind of step away and pray. You're welcome to do that back here in this room and in this room right back there where that door is open. There's some space. You could go back in there and just pray. And actually, Josh and Kimberly Anderson are sitting back there by that room, not as gatekeepers of the room. They look kind of intimidating right now to me. But they're sitting back there just because we wanted to have some people available here this morning to pray with you. Maybe to listen for a minute. You don't need to share any of your story unless you want to, but we wanted to have some people available if you'd like. You could just stop by and just tap them on the shoulder and say, could we pray? And they'd be glad in the middle of a session while Rebecca or Melinda are speaking, they'd be glad to just step in there and take a minute and just kind of quietly pray with you, even while we're continuing on with the rest of the teaching up front here in the middle of these sessions. So I hope that throughout our time that you'll be better equipped to serve others. Maybe even more importantly than that, I hope that we'll all see God's heart a little more clearly. And throughout the process, I do believe that this won't just be kind of equipping us to serve others in the future. It won't just be kind of theoretical. I do believe that God may be doing some things by the work of His Spirit to minister the gospel of Jesus Christ to our hearts afresh this morning. So I hope that all of those things will be happening throughout our time together. And with goals so important, I'm eager to dive in along with you. Before we do, however, let me say just a couple of words of introduction about the two women who will be speaking this morning. A little while ago, I think I should have thought of this before I got up here. I think it was sometime last fall that I got on the phone with Rebecca to talk about the idea of this seminar. Rebecca Meyer has a bachelor's degree in psychology from Wheaton College. Should I tell people when you graduated? I don't know how I feel. Yeah, let's not do that, actually. I heard and it was funny. But she has a degree in psychology from Wheaton. She also has a master's degree in counseling from Westminster Theological Seminary. Some of you who are familiar with resources from the Christian Counseling and Education Foundation, that center is based at Westminster Seminary, where she got her MA. She also has been serving as a counselor with CrossCare Counseling from 2015 to the present. I'll say a little bit more about CrossCare Counseling before we're done at some point today, or perhaps Rebecca will want to herself. Also, she was a ministry associate for care and counseling at Wheaton College from 2015 to 2019. She spent a lot of time doing counseling conversations specifically related to LGBTQ+ students and questions and issues while she was counseling students there at Wheaton College. Currently, she's also a school counselor at the Field School, which is a classical Christian school in Oak Park. And she and her husband, I believe, do you live in Hyde Park? Am I getting that? Yeah, they live in Hyde Park currently, and she is a mom to Caleb, who is 18 months old and is expecting another child to be are due in July. So thanks for being here right in the middle of pregnancy. And thanks for doing all of your prep throughout pregnancy. Also, when I first called Rebecca because over time, in that season when Rebecca was working at Wheaton College and working with Cross Care Counseling, there were a few people from our church who got care from Rebecca, some of them related to some of these issues that we're talking about today. And I heard wonderful things about her care from those people who were part of our church and talking with Rebecca as a counselor while they were walking through deep waters. I had a few conversations with Rebecca, and I can say that Rebecca has taught me about these things. She's helped me to understand some of these issues better. And so Rebecca very quickly was one of the few people on the short list of people that we wanted to call and say, when we developed a conviction together as elders to say, we want to grow together as a church, we want to equip our church to minister better in these kinds of things, and we believe that God's people need to have a deeper understanding of these kinds of issues. Rebecca was one of the very first people who came to mind. We gave her a call. She was open and eager to come and talk about this topic, which we are very grateful for. But in addition to that, I found out while I was on the phone that Rebecca's mom, Melinda, is a little bit of an expert in these issues as well. And Rebecca, I can't remember if it was the first conversation or if she got back in touch with me within a week and said, I'd be glad to do it, but could my mom come too? And so how cool is this? We have not only Rebecca, but we have Rebecca's mom, Melinda Queen, here as well. Let me give you a few details on Melinda. Melinda has a bachelor's degree in sociology, also from Wheaton College. Fist in the air for the Wheaton crew. Representing. She worked for 35 years in the Johnson County court system in Kansas, in greater Kansas City area. She began as a juvenile probation officer, where she made rehabilitation recommendations to the court about juvenile offenders and provided resources and support to help juvenile offenders complete the orders of the court. Melinda also was a victim advocate, where she helped victims through court proceedings, writing statements, lots of listening, extensive knowledge of the court system, and extensive knowledge of what a victim of a crime often goes through. She's developed and directed the Supervised Exchange Program for 10-plus years, which is a county program for families due to conflict in their marriage or relationship that require a safe way of exchange for children for visitation. Melinda serves in her church called Redeemer Fellowship. A few of you who were at Redeemer, what's now called Redeemer, we were called something else back then, 12 years ago, may remember there was this guy named Kevin Cawley who was a part of our church for a little while. He moved to Kansas City and planted a church there. We claim that we helped plant the church since Kevin came to our church for 2 months before he planted it. That's what a church planting residency involves, right? But he planted that church. Melinda is involved in that church and actually is a leader in the counseling ministry there at Redeemer Fellowship Kansas City, where she trains lay counselors, meet with congregants to provide care and counseling, and also leads and teaches in their women's Bible study ministries. So there's just a little bit of background about Melinda and Rebecca, but beyond the stats that I've read to you in the last couple of minutes, what I'd love for you to hear from me right now is these are not just people who have read a bunch of books on these topics. The reason I called Rebecca to begin with and everything I've experienced in phone calls with Rebecca over the last 6 months or so and in the few times I've interacted with Melinda, I can tell you for a fact, these are not just people who have read a lot of books and know some information. These are people who deeply and genuinely care for other people. And they do so wisely, and they do so in a way that reflects God's heart and helps people move forward in God's healing and restoring agenda in their lives. And so, with their background of expertise and also with their hearts of Christ-reflecting love, I'd like to invite you all to join me in welcoming first Rebecca to come and speak to us this morning. Would you join me in welcoming Rebecca here?
Thanks, Josh. Good morning. I actually want to start our time together because, well, I'll go over a little bit of logistics. If you're really into timing and numbers, we might get off on the schedule in front of you. So I just want to name that from the beginning. If that makes you nervous, we are going to be breaking our time up into three sessions. The first session I'm going to lead, and we're kind of having a conversation around what is abuse. And the goal of that session isn't just for us to download a dictionary definition of abuse into our brains, but it's to walk away equipped to talk about abuse. I think abuse becomes very prevalent, not because we don't think it's wrong. If you're gathered here today, I'm assuming you're on the same page that it's wrong, but it's incredibly difficult to talk about and to help people identify and for the victim themselves to identify. So that's what we're doing the first session. We'll have table conversation as well as Q&A after every session. You'll see that there's a Google Voice number on the schedule in front of you where you can text in anonymous Q&A questions that Katie is going to read for us. My mom will also join for that, each of the Q&As. The second session, my mom is going to talk about walking with someone who has experienced abuse. And then the last session, we're going to talk about protection and prevention. Like Josh said, we have these aspirational goals and hopes, but the tone of this morning is, I think, is going to kind of waffle between this is very sobering because we know abuse is sin. It's also incredibly hopeful work. When people, you know, hear about my job and know that these are the conversations I most frequently find myself in, like, I would not want to do that. There's a weight to what we're stepping into this morning. But I found that because abuse is so horrible, there's only one place to go when you're confronting it, and that's to Jesus, straight into Jesus' arms, straight into the word that reveals Jesus to us. And so I have just a profound sense of hope and excitement that I'm not having the conversation this morning with someone who's a victim telling me their story and we're looking back, but I'm talking to people that have been victimized most likely, can look back on their stories, but also we get to look forward together and we get to say, not only is this not okay, but we're going to become, step into our calling as ambassadors to not allow this to happen, to be agents of healing and hope in our churches. So I'm actually going to have you all start talking because we're going to do a little bit of table discussion. I don't want our first table discussion to be like a really weighty, heavy stepping into what is abuse. So I just want you to spend some time at your tables, if you haven't already, introducing yourself and sharing with your tables, why did you say yes to being here this morning? I'm so impressed. When I saw 8 a.m. on the schedule, I was like, wow, it's going to be my mom, Josh, and I. but it isn't. So I'm going to give you about 5 minutes to go around and have that conversation with your tables. So this morning we're talking about our understanding of what is abuse, and we start by recognizing that abuse is unequivocally sin. It is the very opposite of who God is and an affront to God in every way. Abuse is also not an out there issue. As I was driving in to Naperville this morning, I was thinking about what if the Chicago Tribune or some newspaper that loves to talk about how terrible Christians are knew that there were 60 Christians gathering this morning to equip ourselves to respond effectively to abuse. I think that this is a very powerful voting with our feet to say that we recognize this is sin and we're not going to just kind of sit back and roll our eyes and say this is affecting other people, but we're really embracing that it's part of our lives, part of our congregation's life. The definition that I pulled that's in front of you in your handout for this question, what is abuse, I'm going to read out. Abuse is defined as a pattern of behavior used by one person to gain and maintain power and control over another. If you're like me, when you read theoretical definitions, it just goes right through your head and it doesn't have any stickiness. But the one thing that I wanted to pull out from this definition is the language power and control over another. That abuse always has an element of somebody who has leverage in the relationship using that against the victim. But as Christians, I think we can have an even more succinct definition of abuse than the one that I just read. In Genesis, when God creates Adam and Eve, he names them as his image bearers. And so the very opposite of treating someone as an image bearer is treating someone as an object. Abuse is simply when you treat another person as an object. And this has far-reaching, catastrophic ramifications. Going back to the idea of image bearers, the fact that we bear God's image should immediately eliminate the potential to treat anybody as an object. We could spend the rest of our lives marveling at the fact that every single person in this room bears God's image uniquely and effectively. And that is a very interesting and effective way to spend our time. But we blow right past that, and we find ourselves in the midst of the chaos and confusion of sin very quickly in the Bible. Abusing someone is also the opposite of loving our neighbor. The command invites us to love our neighbor as we love ourselves. And so as I think about abuse, I have a weight to think about the abuser who must hate themselves so much that they're willing to treat another person however they've chosen to abuse that person. So what does abuse do? What are some of the characteristics of abuse? Here are four. Abuse teaches people that they are trash. If someone is an object, they're expendable, they're shameful, or they're bad. Abuse makes it very difficult for the victim to have a relationship with themselves or people around them. Again, it's cutting against the very image of God that we bear. Abuse is also crushing and it oppresses. We're gonna spend some time reflecting on different kinds of abuse, and we'll be talking about what happens in the moment. But as we consider the specific moment of abuse, we realize that it continues far beyond that actual moment. And actually, a lot of going back through your story of abuse can be just as traumatic as going through the abuse itself. So it's oppressive. It lasts, the impact of it. This, to me, is the most important thing that we recognize when we're talking about abuse. But abuse is an all-time silencer. Abuse loves the shadows and darkness and secrecy and chaos. If you're a victim of abuse, it's almost impossible to talk about abuse. Because why would you be able to tell somebody, this is what I've allowed someone, this is how I've allowed someone to treat me? Victims live with the false perception that they've allowed someone to abuse them. And how could you possibly put language on that if you're trying to name and identify abuse? That's why our job this morning is so important, to become people who, when we hear those stories, we say, this is what I'm hearing. That doesn't sound like someone's treating you as if you really do bear the image of God. We're stepping into that space gently, but hopefully, pushing against that silence. We have to acknowledge. And the last character of abuse I want to highlight this morning is that abuse does spiritual damage. No matter what kind of abuse you've gone through, physical, verbal, emotional, abuse hides the love of the Father, because it's using the very nature of what God has promised himself to you against you. Abuse does not happen in a random assault on the street. These are people that you know, and God has said, this is a good relationship with your mom or your dad or a cousin or a Sunday school teacher or a pastor. And they're using that safety and that power that we identified earlier against you. And so when you meet a God who is authoritative, who speaks clearly into your life, why would you want to trust that God? It hides the love of the Father. It renders the idea of safety almost incomprehensible. If these people that I'm supposed to walk with and trust don't keep me safe, don't value me in a way where I can feel comfortable, why would I trust God to do that? Think of the words of Psalm 23 to a victim: God is my shepherd, I shall not fear. If you can't trust the shepherd, then all you can do is live with fear. And I'm just going to restate that. That abuse shatters the thought or the hope of a safe shepherd, let alone the idea that God gave himself for the sake of his lambs. The very kind of high point of our faith, that we serve a God who condescended and lived on earth among us to serve, to sacrifice himself for us, is very confusing to a victim, because the abuser has done the opposite of that, has given no ground, allowed no space for the victim in the relationship. And so it's very difficult to explain that or to reconcile that if you're a victim of abuse. Today we're going to talk about five different kinds of abuse. There are absolutely more. But these are the ones that kind of rose to the surface as I was praying through what we're going to identify today. So they're physical, emotional, sexual, financial, and spiritual. And I want to talk about aspects of each of those for a little bit. Is this microphone okay? When I talk over here, you can't hear me, but then when I talk over here, you can. So I'm going to move it. Okay. So the first kind of abuse we're identifying is physical abuse. And that's using physical power to gain control, to manipulate someone, or to intimidate, ultimately making someone feel physically unsafe. That basis of physical abuse is the idea that you're using this for something else. It's not a one-time physical aggressive act, but it's repeated, it's insinuated in the relationship that I can and I will use physicality to get you to do what I want. This is physical intimidation, it's physical threats. It's not just what you see on a crime show on TV, but it's just referencing, well, you know, the knives are right over there. I know that, you know that. Let's just make this easy and you do what I want, right? It's somebody who's actually living with that. And it's interesting to talk about physical abuse because no one has stepped into a counseling room with me, started telling me their story and led with, hey, Rebecca, I want you to know that I was a victim of physical abuse. But they start describing a relationship where, you know, my partner always dug their nails into me when they were giving me a hug just to remind me. They don't think that that's physical abuse, but every time they're moving towards a safe, intimate, secure interaction with their partner, they're filled with fear. And in the back of their mind, they know this could escalate very, very quickly if I do something wrong, right? So they're very focused on their behavior and their response. It's slamming a fist on the table. It's breaking something. It's allowing anger to become such a central part of the communication that the anger externalizes to using an object or physical violence against somebody. I think it's so important that the person who has been physically abused has not just read through this list like we're doing right now. They've actually feared for their life, and they don't know how they're going to make it to the next interaction with their abuser or wherever they're headed next. So this is hard for someone who hasn't lived through this to enter into. So I don't want to be weepy or dramatic, but I do want us to kind of carve out space in our brain that when someone is talking to us about their experience of physical abuse, we've paused to think, what would I do if I didn't know I was going to have another breath? That's how serious physical abuse is. The next kind of abuse that we're going to talk about is emotional abuse. When I was talking to Josh, I thought he raised a really interesting point that this can be verbal emotional abuse can be hard to identify because it doesn't look like physical abuse. I hear, you know, maybe a very grotesque thing in the newspaper about someone's experience and you think, well, that wasn't me. He just called me these horrible names over and over and over again for years and years and years. And you also detach from verbal or emotional abuse because the emotions are yours. The abuser didn't make you feel that way, but you were tormented by these emotions of fear, chaos, confusion that the abuser kind of suggested to you through the verbal or the emotional abuse. Does that make sense? It's kind of hard to identify, and it's very, very difficult for victims to identify, but it includes name-calling, demeaning comments, intentionally humiliating someone, attacking, or sarcasm. I want to pause on sarcasm because I'm not a very funny person, so I have to rely on sarcasm when I want to try to be funny. In peer-to-peer relationships, that's normally fine because a peer can say, hey, Rebecca, that wasn't funny, or what did you mean by that? But if you're a Sunday school teacher, or you're a pastor, or you're charged with shepherding of any kind, sarcasm can be a very powerful and a confusing way to kind of remind someone of, like, I'm above you, I have this great sense of humor that you may or may not understand, and the person trying to track and to follow what you're saying doesn't understand that. And the abuser uses that against the victims because they say, well, you just don't understand me. But if you are truly someone who possesses power, Your job is not to remind people constantly of your power, but it's to enter into their life and to raise them up with the power that you possess. And so I think we have a lot of ministry leaders in the room, and I just wanted to highlight that to say, are we being sensitive to the way sarcasm isn't always verbal abuse, but it can kind of be seeds or maybe an indicator if someone really relies on that. I'm wondering, okay, what else is there in your pattern of language and how you interact with people? Are people feeling safe and known and like that they can use their voice in the relationship with you? An aspect of verbal and emotional abuse is mental and psychological abuse. I grouped all of that together in preparing for a conversation today, even though we could definitely isolate them. But that would include systematic tearing down of another person and really getting them to believe you cannot trust your own thoughts. Every type of abuse really chips away the foundation of your relationship with yourself and being able to tap into and trust your gut, but especially verbal and emotional psychological abuse. The next kind of abuse that we are identifying this morning is sexual abuse, and that's forced sexual acts using intimacy as a weapon for control. This includes forced exposure to sexual content. We often think that it's just repeated rape, pushing someone beyond the physical boundaries that they're comfortable with. It includes recording somebody without their consent against their will, or using that to manipulate and control, even if you never publish it, just saying like, I have these pictures that we took that one time, maybe when you did agree to it, I'm not afraid to publish them or send them out to you. That would be sexual abuse. Consent is the word that you are always going to hear when sexual abuse comes up. I think that is way too low of a bar for our understanding of sexual abuse. As Christians, intimacy is exciting, a good gift, and begins way before sex or physicality ever comes into the relationship. But I want to define consent for us today. So giving consent means that I'm able to say no, and that I understand the request enough to be able to agree to it. I highlighted in the resources a book called A Theology of Sex by Beth Felker Jones, where she argues in the book that you cannot, as Christians, give consent for sex outside of marriage. I think that puts a lot of people back, and she has to do a pretty good job of convincing, but she has me convinced, because I think if we really understand and want to value sex as God has created it to be, it is incredibly difficult to say I fully know what I'm saying yes to if I'm having sex outside of marriage. And I don't say that to be like kind of like perpetuating purity culture and making people who have sexual histories feel bad about it, but to say there's good news for our sexuality here and in Scripture, and it's better than anything that we're walking with right now. Does that make sense? A little bit of a rabbit trail. But Josh did say I spent a lot of time working with LGBTQ students, and I've spent a lot of time talking about sexuality. The next type of abuse we're identifying is financial abuse. This, I think, is actually more prevalent in the church and maybe in religious settings because of how we've set up our families for usually one partner to be working and one partner to be home taking care of the kids. And so financial abuse happens when one partner is using money or finances to manipulate, to establish control, and uses that eventually to debase the personhood of their partner. So it's when somebody doesn't have access to or knowledge of the finances, or the abuser will dole out small amounts of money, kind of like an allowance for someone. And financial abuse is incredibly isolating because it's almost, we don't talk about our finances with people. It's very easy to hide and to make that private. And if you don't understand what's going on with your finances, how would you be able to talk to your small group leader about, hey, I'm given $5 a week for coffee with friends? Or you have to like turn in receipts to your abuser proving how you spent the money. It's very controlling, and it's very, very confusing for a victim. I also think financial and economic abuse is the least able to be identified because the victim has no way of leaving the relationship. If they haven't been allowed to work for years and years and years, how would they accumulate the money to take the kids get out of the house, find a safe way, and then re-enter the workforce. It's incredibly intimidating and overwhelming. So as pastors, as a church, we need to be sensitive to that. It includes extorting money or requiring payment for just being part of the household. The last kind of abuse is spiritual abuse. And I pulled the definition that Diane Langberg uses. That's the person that we've most heavily relied on in preparing for today. Diane Langberg defines spiritual abuse as when the shepherd uses the sheep for food rather than feeding the sheep. So the shepherd, instead of saying, I'm going to use my power to support, help, minister, and nurture you, ends up consuming the sheep. And we see these stories as Christians of congregations of people who have been totally exploited by the people they've trusted as their spiritual leaders. This includes using scriptures to demean or to manipulate. And my mom is going to spend more time on specific ways that that happens in the church and specific scriptures. I've noticed in spiritual abuse, knowledge is a big part of it, that someone kind of has this like, well, I know this about the Bible, and we're drawn to that. We're Christians. We want to learn and to grow. And instead of saying, okay, I'm going to equip you to go to the text yourself and to walk with me kind of in a partnering sense, they always have more knowledge than you. And so in the relationship you grow, you become more and more dependent on this pastor or on this person with spiritual authority, and you become less and less sure of your ability to read the Bible, of your ability to walk with God. I even see it with people who become very reliant on a podcast. There are amazing podcasts out there, and I love listening to them. But I'm always kind of have to check myself to say, do I think more highly of this person's relationship with God than of mine? Because if you go to scripture, God is saying, come to me, I invite you to myself, all of us, no matter if we can read or we can write or whoever we are, no matter how old we are, our intellectual abilities. And so if you're a spiritual abuser, you are not acknowledging that. You are always going to be pushing people to say, come closer to me, rely on me for that. Another element of spiritual abuse is not accommodating other ways to walk with God. You see, walk into these churches where there's spiritual abuse and everybody looks the same, because there's one person who has this great personality, and to be close to God like that person, I need to act like them, dress like them, walk like them, talk like them, live like them. Again, if we are truly all image bearers, we get to wear, express how we want to look with our clothes that might not look like what the pastor or the spiritual leader is wearing. We get to be ourselves as we walk with God, and a kind shepherd encourages people to step into their personalities as they seek sanctification to grow into that, not to kind of choke that out. Are we tracking with that? Well, like I said at the beginning, we don't talk in definitions. I have never once sat with somebody and said, I'm going to read to you this definition of theory about abuse. If I did, that person would fall asleep and never come back to talk to me again. And I wouldn't blame them. We are talking to people. We're talking to people being actively victimized, or people who have stories where they maybe haven't identified what they've been through. The frequent exposure of abuse in the media, I would say, it's a double-edged sword. We realize the horror of abuse as we read other people's stories. But like I said earlier, abuse is an all-time silencer. And so we think, well, that story that's the headline this week, that's not my story. I could never show up to a small group and say, you know, this is what I'm going through, because it's not as bad as that person's story. And so how do we become people who draw this forward in appropriate ways? I'm not saying every small group is this big reflection on who's been abused. But how do we help people be sensitive to that? And so this next section I want to talk about, identifying who you're serving and talking about abuse in a way that draws their story forward. I think we feel pretty comfortable when Rebecca's reading these comfortable, maybe a little bored when Rebecca's reading these definitions to you. But what if I were to say, okay, could you describe physical abuse to a child who's 5? Or could you define sexual abuse, talk about sexual abuse with a premarital couple? That's harder. That's almost a non-starter. And the reason that it's hard is because abuse is sin, and it's chaotic, and it's confusing. I'm not saying that it should be easy, but I think we can grow in being able to talk about it. So I'm going to go through a few of these developmental categories that you see in front of you, and then I'm actually going to have you work on this a little bit more at your tables. My favorite category to talk about abuse with is children. I work at an elementary school right now, and I spend actually a lot of time with our pre-K students. The reason I like talking to pre-K students about abuse is because I don't talk about abuse. We start with our youngest kids talking about the opposite of abuse, talking about who Jesus is. We talk about safety and love and trust. I think the anthem for our 0 to 5, even beyond that, of anti-abuse is the song, Jesus Loves Me. This has it all. Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Right, we're telling our children, don't take my word for it. Go to the Word, go to Scripture. How can I help you see that there is someone unlike anyone else who's ever walked the face of the planet who is the definition and the being of trust and love and safety? If there's one thing you remember that I say from our entire time together, it's not to underestimate the fact that children can and will respond to Jesus Christ, no matter how old they are, whatever their abilities are, whatever they've gone through. That is something to be very excited about. Even though this is sobering, this is hopeful work. And so all we get to do is to point people to Jesus, especially children. So we're creating a culture where they can say, if somebody touches them inappropriately or yells at them, anything like that, like, I know someone who wouldn't talk to me like that. My mom and my dad or my Sunday school teachers, they've introduced me to someone who never raises their voice in that way. That's Jesus. Kids are discerning enough to know that. And so we talk about that all the time with kids, and we're hopeful about it. And then when they start saying, like, yeah, but so-and-so made me promise, like, I couldn't talk about it. And you say, oh, help me understand. I want to know more about your story, because you've equipped them to recognize that that is the aberration, what this person of trust and love and safety tried to convince them as a secret. And they know Jesus would never tolerate that in my relationship with Jesus. Like I said, that's my favorite. I could spend our whole time talking about it. But we also, just a practical one, is letting kids initiate physical touch. My sister is a teacher, and when kids come in the morning, they get to do high five, handshake, or hug. As Sunday school teachers, we're sensitive to kids initiating that. Of course we want to give hugs if someone wants a hug, but we're also teaching them, I can choose how I physically engage. We equip our children to name their body parts and to know who they can talk about their body parts with. We're not embarrassed about curiosity or using appropriate language, but we're saying there's a time and a place, and this is always good news. Sexuality, being embodied image bearers, is a good thing. Let me help you as an adult in your life to steward that in the right direction. Moving on to kind of the next developmental age with our students, I'm very sensitive to kind of this almost idolatry that we have around secrecy and confidentiality. I'm a counselor, so confidentiality is part of my job, and I have a high value of it in that way. But in our relationships, in our congregations, if someone is really obsessed with secrecy and privacy, I'm a little skeptical of that. How are we helping our children talk about things in the right way with the right people? The biblical foundation that I always go back to, especially at this age, is we are people who walk in the light. How can I help you do that? If abuse is darkness and Jesus is light, how are we moving towards the light, even in places that it's pretty difficult to talk about? We're talking to our kids about, there are things you're going to want to talk to mom and dad about. Mom and dad don't keep secrets from each other. A lot of times the abuser, like I said, operates in the darkness, so really we'll try to make the child promise, don't tell anybody, not even, and then they'll list the people that they're cutting the child off from. And so as Sunday school teachers or as parents, however you're caring for these children, you realize this is a collaborative approach to care for the child. If a child is making a disclosure of abuse to you, and they say, okay, well, you have to promise not to tell anyone, actually, as mandated reporters, we cannot make that promise. And we don't package that as bad news for the child. We say, this is actually a really cool part of my job that I'm going to talk to our pastors or whoever the person is, the contact person, to say, because we need wisdom. And even your Sunday school teachers get to work and walk with people in wisdom and love. We're not gossipy. We're not like spreading things around or letting stories get off the track. But we are being wise and judicious and always hopeful, even when it's really hard things to talk about. I've linked a training for a mandated reporter, or I've listed that in the resources. And I would encourage, it's a free training, everyone to take that training. I think it's really well done. Another thing with children is we're very sensitive to controlling patterns of play. A rule at the school where I work is that anyone can always join an activity, but you can't change the rules of the game. And so that really puts on the child who might be tempted to control the situation. It challenges them to become a team player and equips the children who might kind of get like washed along by the controlling personality to say like, no, this is what we're gonna do and that's okay, but everyone can still join. Does that make sense? We are going to do sex ed earlier than whenever your parents probably did it. I think I was in fourth grade and we were talking in preparation about even beginning an appropriate level of sex ed as early as second grade. And we're packaging that sex ed not as I'm reading like about these rules that are kind of awkward and I'm embarrassed about. No, this is good news. If God truly made us embodied people for a reason, this is exciting. This is something to steward and look forward to and something you can talk about in the right time in the right place. These are all ways that we talk about abuse without actually talking about abuse. We're equipping the child to be sensitive and prepared when an aberration occurs. Is that making sense? I want to highlight kind of in our next ages, 13 through 17, college post-grad, a handout that you got at the beginning that says, why does he do that? This is not a Christian resource, but it's my favorite in helping a victim identify possibly an abusive relationship. And how I use it in a counseling setting is someone will be describing a relationship to me, and I just kind of pause and I say, oh, you know, I'm confused about why this person talks to you like that. How does that make you feel? We're connecting our experiences to our emotions. And then I say, you know, this sounds actually more serious than how you're describing it. Again, I'm not freaking out. I'm not saying you're a victim of abuse right from the beginning. I'm saying let's interact with something who can put this person can put things in words, and you decide if this is your experience. So I'm equipping the victim to have discernment and wisdom as they talk about what they're going through. I've been surprised, this handout probably has typos and could be improved upon, but I'll put this out in front of a client, we'll both go through it together, and we'll cross out the word abuse at the top. They'll say, I'm not comfortable with that word, that's not my experience. And so that's fine, it doesn't have to be that word. But just, you know, stick with me and we'll go through it. So I'll have them highlight anything about their experience. And more often than not, by the end of going through this handout with somebody, they are overwhelmed with a sense of clarity about the kind of relationship that they're in. I'm not saying you need to do that, but this handout I think does a really good job in that whole book of talking about abuse, but doing it in a way where the victim sees themselves in what they're going through. Two other resources that I want to point out before I send you all off is there's a website, darbystrickland.com. She's a CCF counselor. She has a premarital abuse screener, which as a counselor, this is like one of our all-time favorite resources because we're terrified of sending these premarital couples often to marriages without identifying abuse. And so you can use that different ways. There's instructions in the handout how to use it, but I think even a small group leader could take this handout and just say like, we want to get to know you. I think this should absolutely be included in your premarital work with couples. And helping people identify all these different kind of patterns. This isn't just sexual abuse, but all the kinds that we've identified today. But there's also on the Darby Strickland resource list, a marital abuse screener. And it's similar, but a little bit different for marriage. So I've talked a lot about, like I said, sobering, but hopeful work. And now I want to kick it out to you all at your tables. How would you talk to the people that you're serving about abuse? I've rattled it off and kind of made it seem straightforward. I've had a lot of time to prepare for this conversation, but I want us to leave here more prepared than when we started. So how, first I want you to identify who you're most likely to be serving. Maybe you do it developmentally, maybe you do it by the type of ministry that you're in, and then to talk at your table with how you would incorporate this. If you're a small group leader, how are you going to teach about David and Bathsheba in a small group setting? Are you just going to gloss over the fact that David basically raped Bathsheba, or are you going to be sensitive to that? How would you do that well? Or if you're teaching Sunday school and a few kids get into a heated argument beyond what is maybe normal for that age group, how do you enter into that and talk about what just happened in a way that equips the child to respond differently next time, or identify maybe where they're picking up on that kind of conversation? Does that prompt make sense? Do you feel like you can kind of take it and run with it at your tables for a little bit? The affirming silence. So go ahead and do that. If you get really confused or off track, wave me down. But we'll spend about 10 minutes. Okay, if you're sharing right now, go ahead and wrap up, and we're going to transition to Q&A.